This show, we're going local. And by that I mean we are talking about great artists in this city of Vancouver. You'll hear from Rosario Anser, who is the founder and director of the Vancouver International Flamenco Festival, which is celebrating its 25th anniversary this year. And to celebrate, they're performing a retrospective of their time here. Some highlights from past performances. They will also have the Vancouver premiere of All Stars, Andres Peña and Pilar Ogala, who will perform a piece called Cadiz de la Frontera. I got to speak with Rosario last week. You'll also hear from Wendy Atkinson, who is the program manager at the Chan Center for the Performing Arts at UBC, and I got to speak with her about the Beyond Words series, which is a small couple of shows they do every season. They've had people like Shane Coizan, Ivan Coyote, and Ray Spoon. And coming up, they're doing a great spoken word show with two artists of Haitian descent, a poet and a violin player. So you will be hearing from Wendy about that. And our music guest today, I'm super excited. He's a local boy by the name of Jay Malinowski. You may remember Jay as one of the founders and frontman of the great Canadian reggae band Bedouin Sound Clash. He's got a new project out called called The Dead Coast. And they just released an album, Martel, last year. And speaking of Martel, Jay is releasing a book of stories with that album. And he's also getting back into it here in Vancouver last weekend. So you'll be hearing from him about that. But we'll start with a song off the song, The Tall Shadow from Saint Malo.
Trouble, you're a kid. tall shadow from St. Malo.
My first guest of flamenco in Vancouver. She leads workshops across Canada and in Mexico, and in 2012 was nominated for the Inspirational Latino Award for Arts and Culture in Vancouver, and in 2009 was given the Isadora Award for Excellence in Choreography by the Dance Center. She is Rosario Anser, and I got to speak with her last week. You are the artistic director of the Flamenco Festival, and I know you founded it in 1990. What was your impetus for creating a festival like this?
Oh, well, when we arrived to Vancouver, there was some aficion. There has always been some aficion of flamenco here, but nothing else local. So I was a little bit, we can say, disappointed that we moved from Spain, where, you know, flamenco is everywhere, and thinking of how we can make this accessible to Vancouver audiences. And at the same time that we started the festival, we also founded a school.
Spain is perhaps one of the most dance-rich cultures in the entire world, and Canada is perhaps a little bit lacking in that regard. What did you want to help Canadians to discover about your culture and your type of dance?
What Canadians can discover about flamenco is, that, first of all, they all really make a relation between flamenco and passion. And of course, it's a very passionate dance, but it's very rhythmic driven. So you learn a lot of rhythms. When you come and learn about flamenco, you go yourself into a whole different culture, and it's very here and now. I always feel that in these days that everything is so technically, people is more isolated or goes also fast. Flamenco attract us and make us feel, make us to look inward, make us to feel, to be in touch with our feelings and emotions. That's what the power of flamenco.
It also seems to be quite technically difficult in comparison to some of the other dance forms out there. How do you approach teaching it from that aspect?
Well, yes, totally. It is very difficult and always challenging. We have a system here in Trevo, which is accessible to all people who have not done dance before. Even if you are not a dancer, you can try it. It doesn't really matter, actually, your age. We start very simple, showing them the rhythms through hand clapping, palmas, we call palmas, and we introduce them to the technique with the 4-beat rhythm. And it's a progressive learning, so everybody is able to do something in the first year, and of course, the progressive, the syllables are progressive, so next year you do more and you more, and it became more intricate. So it can look very difficult from the outside, but once you are in, you can you can see, you can feel that's something that you can do. Now, it is not easy. It takes a life. You have to grow with flamenco. And the more you learn about flamenco, the more you see that you have to learn more. It's like a life learning art form.
Dance shows have become quite popular on TV, you know, whether it's Dancing with the Stars, So You Think You Can Dance, even something like Dance Moms, and flamenco has been featured occasionally in at least a couple of them. Do you think shows like that are good in teaching us about different styles and different cultures, and how do you find that flamenco has been portrayed?
The same feel that I'm sure the other people feel about modern dance or ballet is what they you see is popular. So it is good to have this awareness of dance, but it's not the real thing, of course, because it becomes a little bit more commercial.
Right.
But I think it's good to expose people. This is a great medium to expose people to dance. And then, of course, if you're interested, you do your homework and you find that flamenco is something more serious, more profound, and with you need more dedication. You know, the Gypsy Kings is a great popular group.
Yes.
That is known everywhere. And a lot of people get hooked with the rhythm. It's very simple what they do. But then the result, if they are interested, then they say, oh, I want to learn more flamenco. And then when you learn more about flamenco, you discover more about flamenco, you understand, wow, this is just the tip top of the what is underneath. Flamenco is a very profound, as I said, very profound art form. And you had to learn about the singing, you had to learn about all the rhythms, the compass, and about the guitar, and how these three elements go together, dancing, singing, and guitar, compass, go together. The backbone of flamenco is what we call compass, is the musical structure. And this is something that takes time before you feel comfortable, totally comfortable with it. And this is what glues together. The singer, the guitarist, and the dancer communicate through the compass.
Let's talk about the two performances that they're highlighting. The first is Cadiz de la Frontera, which has Andres Peña and Pilar Ogala of Cadiz. What can you tell us about this performance?
Well, they are good friends and great artists. He comes from Jerez de la Frontera, which is the most flamenco town that you can find in Spain, in Andalusia. And she comes from Cadiz, very close by, but it's a more tropical, more relaxed. So what the flamenco that he does is a little bit more serious. Then you have the sensuousness and the relaxation of the Pilar Ogaya's style. They both are a couple, so I just flamenco. Actually, Vancouver has never experienced a couple performing. We usually see a solo male or a solo female dancing performing, but this is the first time that we will see a couple performing on stage, and I just can tell you the fire is gonna be, the stage is gonna be on fire. They both are incredible, talented people.
One of the things that intrigued me here as I'm reading the press release is that it talks about the two contrasting worlds, sort of the inland Jerez and then the sort of Cadiz by the sea.
Yes.
Just the storytelling aspect of dance. How is that different than perhaps other mediums such as theater? How can a dance story tell us in perhaps ways that other mediums can't?
Well, I can say that, for example, his dancing, which is inland and is very profound, it is actually the songs are the song form is the Solo Flamenco. And this song is the one that tells the story and sets the mood to what the person will be dancing, the singer and the guitarist. And while Pilar, who comes from Cádiz, they are more indolent. The songs are more happy, relaxed, more indolent. So that sets the style in her dancing. In Spain and Andalusia, they have regional differences, and then each region has families who does certain songs more than other ones. So you first of all have the difference in regions, and then when you go to a region, you can see also differences in neighborhoods, how they do it. So it's very interesting what you can find in flamenco. Now, flamenco is a personal experience, a personal expression. So you can say a lot with what you're expressing flamenco, while you are dancing flamenco. So it is very passionate in the sense, and it's also very, has to be authentic. When you see a good flamenco, is because you can see that this person is very authentic, very in touch, very in tune with his or her feelings or expressions or experiences.
And then the second piece you're doing is your company, Fast Forward Rewind. And my understanding is that it's sort of a review of all your pieces over the past 25 years, or, you know, highlights from that. Why did you decide that, you know, now was the time for a performance like that?
Well, we are celebrating our 25th years of operating, and I thought it was a good idea to revisit some of the works. They are not all of them included. There are some certain works. And what I found out when I was choosing or finding what I would like to do, at the end, when I saw them all together, I said, oh, this is almost like mapping flamenco and also mapping of my experiences. Because we start with Flamenco Roots. This is our first major work. My husband is the musical director of Flamenco Rosario and also the festival. We were exploring the roots of flamenco. What is flamenco? We all know it's here, but where it comes from. So nobody knows it for certain, but everybody agrees that it's a mixture of cultures, Sephardic, Moorish, and Christian cultures, the Gypsy too, of course. So we start with this, the roots of flamenco, and then we come back to Cuadro Flamenco, where flamenco jumped from the, to being a family entertainment, it jumped to the commercial stage. That was the 1800s. That's flamenco, the art form. And then we jumped to when I discovered flamenco, which is an excerpt of Mis Hermanas, Thinking That Water, My Sisters and I, which is an autobiographical work, where the excerpt that we are using is the time that I discovered flamenco and I was smitten and totally in love, and I could not rest until I moved to Spain. And then we jumped to the time that I come to Vancouver, and my way of thinking or my way of expressing changed a lot to be a little more open, more bold, more experimental with the art form. And at the end, we finish with the last work, which just premiered in February. It's about my husband and I relationship in and out of the stage, domestic and artistic life, and how they overlap all the time.
People always say that you shouldn't mix the personal and the professional. How have you and Victor managed to survive by working together all these years?
You know, this is a question that we hear all the time as to us, and we don't know. I think we are committed to each other. We love each other. And after so many years, we become also very good friends. And the fact that we our interest is the same, it's been very helpful to what we do, but also it has brought us a lot of headaches. We both are very strong and passionate people. So, yeah, fireworks on stage all the time. But also, we have overcome that, definitely. It's always, I said it should be this, it should be that. And there is always a good disagreements and arguments, lots of arguments. But at the end, we always manage to create something beautiful. And when we see that, we say always, oh, yes, worth it. Besides, we have two wonderful children that this is our, when we see our children growing up and being happy and content, I think this is the part that as a couple we really cherish. And when we see also our artistic babies, our works being successful or being most of the time they are completed, they are a good work, we say yes, it is, this is worth it. And of course we love each other totally. After all these years, we believe we were meant to be together. Not easy.
We come on the sloop, John B, grandfather and me, around the wonderful we did roam, drinking all night. Got into a fight, oh no. Well, I feel so broke up, I wanna go home. Hoist up the John B. sail, see how the mainsail sets. Call for the captain ashore, let me go home. Let me go home. I wanna go home. Oh no. Well, I feel so broke up, I wanna go home. First mate, he got drunk, broke in the captain's trunk. The constable had to come and take him away. Sheriff Johnstone, why don't you leave him alone? So broken, I wanna go home. So hoist up the John B. sail, see how the mainsail sets. Call for the captain ashore, let me go home. Let me go home. Threw up all of his grits, and then he went and he sat in all of his scorn. Sheriff Johnstone, why don't you leave him alone? Well, I feel so broke up, I wanna go home. Hoist up the John B. sail, see how the mainsail sets. Call for the captain. Malinowski, thanks for being here. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So you've done something very interesting in that you've gone from music and you've released sort of a book of short writings, if I'm correct, like an illustrated novella. What can you tell us about Skulls and Bones and how it became something that you wanted to do?
Well, it started with the Dead Coast record, which I put out last year, a year and a half ago. There were a bunch of songs, and they all had stories behind them. And the way I came to that record was going through my grandfather's notes that he left behind before he passed away, and he was from Cape Breton. And then started looking at, you know, who I became or who I was based on the past and whether we become what we become because of what we determine or whether, you know, it's a set of circumstances that came well before us. And so that's how I started the album. And when I took the songs to my publisher, there are all these stories behind them. And I said, you know, you should write these out. So I began writing out stories, and then that quickly became, like, I didn't want them to just be information. I thought it'd be far more interesting if they were put into allegory or put into a larger perspective. And so I wanted to create a bigger world for this character of Martel, which I created for the album. And so that eventually became this novella. Found a home with it with HarperCollins, and then just kept going from there.
Was it a different writing process for you, the novella versus the songwriting?
Oh, totally. It's entirely, like, I was, you know, I started writing songs when I was 14 or something. And I think with a song, it's, first of all, it's a lot shorter. You can visualize it. You can hear it within usually 4 minutes. And it's sort of on your time, in the sense that you can kind of decide, okay, is it done or is it not? I found with, you know, starting with the initial idea of the book, which I came up with in Spain about 3 years ago, to working through it and actually making the characters alive and truthful, that took a longer time. It works on their time, eventually. You know, your characters kind of decide what's going to happen. So that was about a year and a half process with an editor. And it was definitely, like, in terms of a creative process, by far the most grueling I've gone through, far more than making an album.
And I read that this, at least the ebook version, I think, includes some of your ink drawings. And I know you've dabbled in art before. I believe you had a show in the gallery in Toronto. And is it true that you're unveiling a mural later this month in Vancouver?
Yeah, that is. I have the opening on Saturday. I'm looking at it right now. It's about a 12-foot mural. I went to art school, and originally that was my trajectory. I was going to be doing, you know, I had a gallery deal. And then, you know, Bedouins just started doing really well, and I had a choice. And at that time, I was young, and I was like, I chose music. With the book, I was writing it, and I was thinking, I really wanted to be illustrated because I grew up loving graphic novels, and I obviously love pictures that go along with text. And so I was thinking, oh, I'm going to find someone to do this, you know, I'll find someone to do it. And eventually I realized, like, I just have to do it myself because it's going to, you know, I'd have so much direction with it. And so it ended up being, yeah, both a novella, and then I ended up illustrating it. There's 150 illustrations.
The process for you of creating a picture or something that's inherently more visual than a song, how long does that take you?
How long does it take you to make a pic, to do one of the illustrations?
Yeah, or like just sort of your creative process when you're doing something visual as opposed to something that's more just of a written work.
Okay, so between writing and, it really, really depends. But I think in the end, the same rules of composition apply to everything. You know, there has to be a balance, and you can, you know, whether it's a picture and a golden mean, something's just work. And there's always an element of not knowing what's going to happen, whether it's with writing and you sit down and something just comes up. So it really, I mean, it's just really, it really depends on the specific work. But I find they all kind of complement each other, because something you learn from writing, you can apply to something visual or music.
You know, a lot has happened in the last few years since Bedouin released their last album, and I'm curious why you decided to come back to Vancouver. I'm curious as if that had any impact on your creative output.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I was, you know, Toronto is a totally different place than Vancouver. You know, my friends in Toronto were always like, you know, you miss Vancouver, you should, you know, and I think after being away since I was 18, being close to the family was important. And also when it came to the Dead Coast project, I'd started working on it in Toronto, but really it happened here, and it happened with a group of musicians from Vancouver, the Entry, who are a string trio. They call themselves a squawk dissonant trio, I think. And there's just, I think it's, you know, there's a slower pace here, the attention to detail, at least, with working with the Entry and really focusing in on sounds and listening. I think it was a really rewarding experience, and it couldn't have happened unless I was in Vancouver.
Now, is it true that the Martel album was based on a distant relative of yours?
Yeah, like I said, with my grandfather's notes. So Martel is, you know, like created a fictional just character named strictly Martel. And he's sailing around the world in the 70s. But the namesake comes from Charles Martel, who is first ancestor on my mom's side, who came to Canada in like 1757. And his life was very tumultuous. Like, he's from France. His mother relative had her head cut off, and they're Huguenots, so Protestants. They came over to Canada, settled in Cape Breton, fought with the British against the French at Louisbourg, and then lived on the sea ever since. And my grandfather grew up in a house right on the ocean there. And there's still the graveyard below with all the ancestors and some of the people I wrote about that were anchors on the stones. And I remember growing up and hearing my grandfather talk about this larger-than-life thing. And going back and visiting and seeing it, it was such a great place to start telling a story. And it was so inspiring.
And I read that the album is sort of split into two parts. You got the Pacific and the Atlantic. And given that your family and your ancestry is kind of traversed the whole country, how important was that for you to sort of really be inclusive in that manner?
It's just because I grew up in Vancouver, and the story to me, what I related to in terms of the story is there, and I felt that a lot of people could in Canada. It doesn't matter where your ancestry comes from. We've all come from somewhere, and we're moving somewhere else. But it's just kind of, it was about travel and why, and then taking that and saying a story about someone who is basically on the run, and chooses to live his life on the run, and is sort of running from the past. I could relate to that, and so it was just, to me, the Atlantic and Pacific, and on a larger scale, was two halves of the story. And looking at the ocean as a really deep subconscious where things float in it for long periods of time and then resurface at strange things, kind of like how we deal with memory. And so that's why I split them into two halves.
how powerful can stories and memories be in affecting the way we live our lives, do you think?
I think all we are is memory. I think that, you know, narrative and memory, we're story people. We come from stories. Otherwise, we'd know nothing about who we are. And I think it's how we preserve those and how we tell them again, and why the same stories are always compelling, but they just need to be updated into a relevant way. But I don't think we're anything without stories.
And I'm curious, I wanted to ask you about, I read here that, was it a couple years ago that you ended up walking the Camino de Santiago in Spain? And I read about this all the time because it's quite well known. And what inspired you to do that?
It's one of those things it just kept coming up in conversation. One of those things that, you know, you hear something, someone's talking about an artist or a song, and you're like, it comes up again and again, and you think, I need to check that out, or I need to go do that. But for me, I kept hearing about it, and I had some time, and I thought, you know, after touring for so long, you're always around people, and you're around people who know who you are, and, so I thought it would be a great thing to do alone, and where I just have some time away, and also we're speaking about memory and story, where there is not no story, it's just me there. I went alone and took me 40 days to do it, and it was a great time out.
what does that do to your sort of your mindset, either creatively or how does it make you think about perhaps where you want to go in life, if at all?
I think it's different for everyone. I mean, there's so many people that, specific to doing a pilgrimage or something, everyone's coming from such different places when they do it. Just in a really basic way, I remember, like, because you're walking all the time, everything takes a lot longer. So going 10 miles, that's going to take you a lot longer than in a car. And we move so quickly these days, and we don't think about how quickly we're moving tonight. But I did not think about how quickly I moved. So it just really slows your body down and slows your thought process down.
Do you find that perhaps, you know, society as a whole, we're just too rushed and too quick to accomplish everything?
Oh, I have no idea. Society. I know that there is a struggle, at least with music, especially right now. You know, things come out and things vanish very quickly in the sea of social media, and everyone's vying for attention. And I think sometimes the more subtle things do get lost, and at least by slowing down, you do become more aware of subtleties and things that you're missing. But I have no idea about society. That's more a personal thing.
Fair enough. I know, you know, when you're in Vancouver, you kind of tend to stay in the gas town on the Lower East Side, which for a lot of people outside of Vancouver seems to be one of the more culturally rich areas of town. And how does just that specific part of town inspire you, would you say?
Yeah, it's really important, at least on a daily basis, you're reminded of the good things and the bad things. And in Vancouver, we stratify, the city's so stratified that you can ignore a lot of things. There's such a concern for real estate because it's so expensive to live here. I think the one thing I do appreciate in Gastown is on a daily basis, you see people, and I'm not saying people do this in other areas, but you really do look out for people, or you see people who aren't being looked out for. you know, I think that it's a small community. You know your neighbors, for better or worse. So that's why I enjoy it. I mean, coming from from Toronto, I really wanted to be in a place where I could walk everywhere. So, and there's also a lot of great art and music being made.
What's your take on the Vancouver music scene, especially how it compares to, you know, other places like Toronto?
You know, I mean, because my whole community of musicians and where I started was Toronto, I always feel quite dislocated from stuff happening in Vancouver. I kind of moved back here at the age where you kind of hermit yourself more than go to clubs every night. But I'd say, I mean, I know for myself, it would have been really hard for Beto, and it's just so expensive to get across the mountains and get to even Calgary. But I think, I don't know. It seems like the musicians I meet, though, there seems to be a thoughtfulness. I think because it's sort of incubated from the rest of the world. And so that's a good thing.
Well, the book is Skulls and Bones, 14 Letters from a Sailor at the End of the World, which was released on September the 1st, and you have your mural being released on September 12th. Jay Malinowski, thanks so much for your time today, man.
Hey, no problem. Thank you for having me.
Cheers.
All right, buddy.
My final guest is the programming manager at the Chan Center for the Performing Arts at UBC. And one of the unique things they do is something called the Beyond Words series. And this year there's a presentation called Blackbird Fly. So what can you tell us about, in general, how this specific series started?
Yeah, the series started a few years ago, and it had sort of an accidental birth. We were approached by the creative writing department, we were talking with creative writing. They were bringing in the artist John K. Sampson, who plays in or used to play in the band The Weaker Thans, and they were bringing him in for a residency. And as part of the residency, they needed him to do a performance. So we thought, well, and they were looking for a space, and we're like, well, we'll present him, and this would be a nice sort of little partnership. And Beyond Words actually grew out of that. So it's the idea of words and performance, and especially often addressing social issues. And so we want it to be not a lecture, not a talk, not a music performance. So John actually talked about his writing process, and that was his songwriting process. And that's what the creative writing department needed him to do. But it also worked for us. So he sang some of the songs and explained how they came about. And that was really the beginnings of Beyond Words, and we wanted to take that idea and develop it a little further, you know, words in different, being used in different ways. And that's really where the series started, and then ever since then we've had, we've done, you know, about 2 shows a year, so it's a small series, but it's, you know, had very different performances, so it's been fun.
And the one you have coming up is a great spoken word artist, Mark Moody Joseph. Mm-hmm. And the violinist Daniel Bernard Roumain.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about this one, how you got these guys to come and that collaboration.
That's a collaboration that they have, that they've performed. This is a Canadian premiere, but they have performed it before. So this is a collaboration they initiated and they've been doing. And it was actually my colleague, Christine, who was talking to their agent and just heard about this project and let me know about it. And I've seen video of it. And I just think they're both amazing artists, and watching them together doing this collaboration, I just thought that's perfect for Beyond Words. And so this is one that they initiated, their collaboration and the work that they're doing together, even though they live on opposite coasts. Daniel's in New York and Mark is in San Francisco. You know, they've managed to create this work that is so integrated, like the two of them. When you watch the video and the way they perform, the way they're integrated, it's not two separate people just doing their thing on stage and happen to be there at the same time. This is really, they're really collaborating. It's quite good.
This seems to be the one that out of all the shows you've had, it seems to have the most culture behind it, because both Mark and Daniel are Haitian born. How important is that aspect of something, to bringing another culture to Canada or to Vancouver?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, our idea for Beyond Words, and it's not every show, but we lean towards shows that have some sort of touch on social issues or touch on cultural issues or something. And because the series is small and still new, we're seeing how that plays out as we book each show. So I wouldn't say it's been part of the series consistently, but it's certainly part that we would like to develop, that we would like to keep doing. And that's another reason this particular show seems like such a good fit for the series. But the social issues that come up in the series can be all kinds of different things. So we presented gender failure, talking about issues around sexual identity and gender identity, Shane Khoisan about bullying. So the social issues that it's addressed can be all kinds of different things. For this particular show, it will be, part of it will be their background, their cultural backgrounds.
You mentioned Shane Khoisan, and of course he's a spoken word artist, mm-hmm. just like Mark Moody Joseph. And although that's an art form that's been around for years, it's really only seemed to have taken off in a much more mainstream way in sort of the last 6 or 7 years, I would say, especially when Shane did his brilliant piece at the Olympics.
Yeah.
When were you first made aware of the art of spoken word?
Oh, you know, that's a good question. I remember seeing slam poetry years ago, Café du Soleil, seeing artists there. That was long before I was programming here. I never thought of it as something, you know, that I would be in a position to program and that it would be at a stage where you'd put it in a concert hall or you'd put it in a theater. It was very much sort of rough and ready and in sort of smaller venues. Like you said, it's really developed. And, you know, Shane doing his piece at the Olympic, even the fact they would book Shane to do something at the Olympic shows how it's become more on the radar of mainstream. So even thinking of it in that way was part of the change of okay, yeah, this is something you can present as, you know, a theater piece, I guess, or whatever you want to call it. But Shane I saw showcase actually at a presenter's conference a number of years before we booked him. And that was where I really saw him. The thing about the Olympics is this huge venue, you're playing to this huge audience and it's televised. I saw him in a more intimate venue, one-on-one with an audience, and that was what appealed to me more than the great big bells and whistles thing. It was this intimate connection with an audience. And I really like that, and that's what I wanted for Beyond Words.
How do you think spoken word and slam can speak to an audience the way, say, maybe music or theater can't?
I guess the ones, and this is my own personal bias, the performers I've seen are the ones who really connect with an audience. Their stories are often intimate, personal. You know, like Gender Failure, I mean, when Ivan Coyote is reading pieces or speaking pieces, it's personal, it's really, you feel like you're really making this connection with somebody. They're telling you something important and personal, and that's, I feel you can do that. In music, it's a bit different. You know, I think that you can do intimate things too, but I think there's a bit of a difference when somebody's telling you something and looking right at you and bearing their soul. And I think that really appeals to people, and especially, you know, a university audience, you know, at that age where people are trying to figure out their lives, you know, and you know, often in their early, mid-20s, trying to figure things out, having somebody say, you know, sometimes it's really hard, and here's how I've dealt with it, and here are the things that have happened to me. I think that really speaks to any age group, but particularly the age group that we're surrounded with, as students on campus.
Is there, I mean, obviously the target audience is students, per se, but although you do have community members come in,
mm-hmm.
but it sort of within that broad spectrum, is there a target audience within that?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, you'd like to think that things appeal to a very broad range, but I don't know if that's true. And with Beyond Words, because every show is so different, I expect that this people who came to Gender Failure, the people who came to Shane Coison, and the people who come to Blackbird Fly will probably be different. I mean, there may be some overlap, but I also suspect each show has tapped into different people with their own interests and their own concerns. And that's fine, too. You know, it's the challenge. You know, it's something that's too mainstream, that appeals to a huge variety of people, becomes more bland. I like things that are, maybe it appeals to a very specific group of people, but it can be, can really speak to that group of people rather than something that kind of generically speaks to a wider range.
Well, you mentioned mainstream, and I think I did too earlier, and that is sort of an issue that people are discussing in terms of what that actually means anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Like what is mainstream? Because you have, you know, social media and you have YouTube, and everything is everywhere now.
Yeah.
What does mainstream mean to you, and how do you think that world has changed or evolved in the last decade or so?
Oh, that's a huge question, Dan. I mean, off the top of my head, and I'd love to give it more thought, but I know this is a short interview, but before, you know, and I'm of that generation, when you watch TV, this was the only thing on. You know, whatever was on the TV at that point, everybody watched it, right? So everybody had the same sort of reference points, and that was mainstream because that was the only thing on. Now mainstream is so different, and I guess I would count mainstream as something that, you know, what gets the most hits, what appeals to the most people, and often it's the easy stuff, the most bland. But now you can do, you know, keep hearing the term that people can curate their own experience. There's so much out there, you can't absorb it all, so it's finding the things that matter to you and curating that, so finding the videos, the music, the spoken word, whatever it is that appeals to you, and focusing on that. And I guess that could be mainstream because it's very popular and you know, appeals to a wide range of people, but often it's not, and that's the beauty of it. You can really drill down to the things that matter to you, and it can be very specific. And it's one reason we do this series in our smaller venue. In the 1,200-seat concert hall, you need to appeal to 1,200 people who are willing and available that night to come and watch a show. Our smaller venue is about 250 seats, and so you can present things that are a little riskier and, you know, maybe don't have huge widespread appeal, but will appeal to a certain group of people who want to, you know, who are aware of these artists and who want to come to this type of performance. So it does give us a little more flexibility to present when we present in the smaller venue.
I think sort of on the opposite end of the spectrum, you have terms like underground, subversive, performance art. But does it bring up the issue that maybe as a society we're trying too hard to put a label on things sometimes and not just letting it be what it is in that moment?
Yeah, and I think that's the challenge we're always going to bump up against when there's so much stuff. How do you characterize it enough for somebody that they know it's my stuff? That's my stuff. I want to go check that out. So you need to give them enough context so they know it could be of interest to them, but not so much where you're labeling it and putting it in a box, going, hey, you're X type of person. You're going to like X because it fits in the box that you are interested in. So I think it is a challenge, and I think with so much stuff out there, you do need to have a way to be guided towards the things that will interest you. But I think it is a big challenge because you don't want to label it so much that it falls into a box and the safe little box that only people who are interested in that will look at it. I mean, and, you know, that's the same thing with our show. You know, yes, the performers have Haitian backgrounds, but we don't want people who are only interested in Haiti at the show because they're talking about so many other things. So you want to make sure people realize there's more going on, not to box it, like you were just saying, not to box it so much that people who might really enjoy it go, oh, that's not my thing. You know, it's a challenge.
Yeah.
Marketing in particular has to deal with that.
I mean, Vancouver's probably one of the few cities where events like this have such a wide audience because there is such a theater community, such an artistic community, and such a varied student community, I guess, in the city. What have you found in the 3 years or so that this series has been up, the response from the larger Vancouver community has been like?
It's been good. I mean, you know, you had mentioned earlier that appealing to students. And that's certainly, because we're on campus, that's certainly one of the prongs of things that we're trying to do is to appeal to students. So it's a certain age group, certain outlook, a certain group of people. So we're trying to do that, but we want to appeal to the wider community too. And so that's definitely, you know, to our marketing efforts certainly go beyond campus, and we try to throw the net wide. And again, it comes back to your question about characterizing something. If you characterize it, if you label it, this is a student thing, then other people might go, well, that's not for me. Whatever student thing means, that isn't me, so I wouldn't be interested. You don't want to label it like this is just of interest to a certain age group or a certain type of person. So even though we have that in mind, you know, when I'm thinking about that when we're booking it, you know, trying to appeal to that group, I don't want to narrowly describe it as a student event either. We want it to be open to the wider community. We want people to feel that this is something for them as well. And again, that's a challenge. We're on campus. We want to throw the net wider than campus, though. You know, have the community here. Community, more than welcome. Everybody come.
So this latest one, Blackbird Fly, how would you describe it to an outsider or someone who's unfamiliar with it?
Well, I guess, I mean, the starting point is kind of what the artists have done on their own. So you have Daniel, who's a virtuoso musician, violinist, but he's worked with all kinds of different people. So he's not the kind, he's classically trained, but he's not in that world. And then you have Mark, who's a spoken word artist, but he also used movement. And so it's, the things I've seen, they're like dance performances with words. Like he's using his whole body in some of the things I've seen. And so you take these two guys and you put them together and you go, well, it would be easy to say the musician stands on the side of the stage and Mark will be up front saying his words. I mean, that's kind of the typical way when you think of even a lead singer in a band or something, but that's not what these guys do. They really do integrate it, and that's the thing that interested me the most and what I would try to tell people. It's like, if you want to see music and dance, what I would call dance or movement, and his words all integrated in talking about these issues. And they're talking about serious issues, but they're not doing it in a lecture kind of way. It's really compelling to watch them perform together. So I guess that's how I try to describe it.
Well, the event is Blackbird Fly, and it is on the 25th. Of September, which is, I believe, a Friday, at 7:30 p.m. at the Chan Center Performing Arts, the smaller stage, which is the TELUS.
Yes.
TELUS stage at the Chan Center Performing Arts. It's a great little sort of round
black box
kind of black circle theater, I guess.
And we set it up in cabaret style, tables and chairs. You can bring in your beverages. It's a very intimate, casual environment.
Wendy Atkinson, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And that was Wendy Atkinson. We're going to take you out today with a final song from Jay Malinkowski and the Dead Coast. This is Skull and Bones. Thanks to Jay Malinkowski, thanks to Wendy Atkinson, and my thanks to Rosario Anser. Special thanks this week to the fine ladies over at Laura Murray PR for helping me get those interviews. You guys do great work. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see y'all next week. Bye, everybody. Bye.
There's a house beyond these walls, with the light left on for all who wander and who fall. For in the missteps walk us all, and see thee if you come, past all those skulls and the land, the road, all those skulls and bones. Betray the soul.